I've listened to it too often. And besides, did you not see that I was inside of you? Now, he said that endlessly to her. Now, I don't want to criticize Louisa, because what do we actually see that's going on inside of ourselves? Don't we run after counselors and spiritual directors and say to people, look, this is what happened to me. What's going on? We're actually very slow to really get it. It's because this is put down objectively on paper that you and I can see it. And it's put down there for our benefit. It's not there for her benefit. It's that you and I need to know that Jesus will never, ever, ever leave us, because we're going straight into the chastisement. And we need to remember that he doesn't leave us. And he said, didn't you realize I was inside of you? Because that's what the church teaches us, that for a soul in grace, that the Blessed Trinity actually indwells us and has been there since baptism. He said, I was inside of you. I wasn't outside of you, he said. And not only me, but the whole world was there. Ah, now she gets it. Not only was Jesus there, because she saw him isolated and she saw herself isolated, and that this space was the world. And so the crushing that he was experiencing, she was getting her dose of that crushing as well. So now she knows what was going on earlier when she described it, and that she felt herself being completely undone, and then that the Lord had to build her up again. Okay. So it's very interesting at this particular point that the Lord shows her how to make reparation for our thoughts. Ouch. You need to go to the book of Proverbs. There's so much about thoughts and words in the book of Proverbs. It's just amazing. But one of the things that the book of Proverbs says, and there's an old translation in my head now, as a man thinketh, so is he. In other words, you are what you think. And if we are to really hand ourselves over to the divine will, the battle is up here. The battle is in our thought life. And if we get the thought life surrendered, we're okay. The feelings will follow like the carriages of the train. The thoughts are the driver's cabin in the train. And people make a huge mistake in thinking that, you know, I can say all these wonderful prayers and everything, but my thoughts are mine. Do you mind? No. St. Paul says in 2 Corinthians 10:5 that every thought must be captured and given to Christ. So if you've never done penance before, try that one. And you'll know what penance is. When you want to criticize somebody in your thoughts, and they've got to stop. So I want to give you just one proverb, 23:7, and as I said, 2 Corinthians 10:5. So in looking at Jesus, Louisa could see his intelligence as something much greater than a son. Now you have to remember, the son is the image in this book for so many things. So the son is a source of light and heat and growth and life for things on the earth. So if she says a sun, it's a source of life and heat and growth and everything else. So I could see his intelligence, she said, as more than a sun. And all the thoughts of Jesus were like many rays which came out of the sun. So picture the sun now and all these rays coming out of it. Okay. And extending, she said, they covered all the thoughts of all human beings, past, present, and future, including yours and mine. These rays, which are the thoughts of Jesus, traveling in order to take, as though in their power, all created intelligence, and to substitute for them as perennial glory to the Father, complete reparation for everything. Because if human beings change the way they think, then the way they run the world automatically changes. The way we run the church automatically changes if we change our way of thinking. So metanoia the Greek word is to change your way of thinking. So Jesus' thoughts, like rays of the sun, covered all the thoughts of all human beings, past, present, and future. In order to substitute for them, oh dear, lots of our thoughts wouldn't stay in the presence of God. And to give complete reparation to the Lord. And also, my book uses the awful word impetration. You have it there as well. And to give intercession, to intercede for all goods, for all created intelligences. Now, here are we sinning away as happy as we like with our thoughts. And the Lord has gone to enormous trouble to cover all our thoughts with his thoughts and to make reparation for all our thoughts. Now, one of the things, if we want the human race to come back to God, is that we have to enter into this reparation and do it as well. So, then drawing me to himself, Louisa said, Jesus told me, my daughter, this son which you see within the intelligence of my humanity was formed by my divinity, and it endowed me with the creative power and the all-seeingness of all things. Now, you know, this is one of these points in Louisa where you could spend the next hour just talking about this. But I'm not going to do that. Perhaps you would do some looking up yourselves. If you go to the prophet Ezekiel and chapter 1, he tries to describe the all-seeingness and the all-knowingness of God. And he describes the most exotic creatures around God's throne. They're all angels. And they have eyes all over the place. Eyes on their wings and on their bodies and on their face and on their head and absolutely everywhere. And that is his graphic way of saying they can see everything. They know everything. They understand everything. Now, this all-seeingness is extremely important because when you go to the gospel, you have Jesus standing in a synagogue and the Pharisees are criticizing him in their thought life, in their minds. And Jesus says, well, why are you thinking this? And then he argues their way out of it. He can read their thoughts. The saints were able to read people's thoughts. Now, reading a person's mind is not actually as difficult as you might think. That's why I'm not going to go down that route. This is big. But one of the signs of a person very close to God is that they can see more and more and more and more because you are penetrating into the sphere of eternity. And you are taking on their way of thinking and being and seeing and hearing and understanding because you're beginning to live a divine life. And a divine life will see through all the mess that's on the earth. And all the total waste of time that's going on. And he said, he used this all-seeingness, he said, in such a way that I was able to be a new sun for souls. Now, capital S this time. Therefore, Jesus became the source of light. And in the scriptures, life and light are interchangeable. So I want to give you John chapter 1, verses 1 and 9, that Jesus is the light of life. Okay? And he's the life of light. So light and life are interchangeable. And in John 8, 12, Jesus said, I am the light of the world. In other words, it is through me, with me, and in me that you will see. Now that's also, what is it, Sam? I think it's 36 verse 9. Lord, in your light, we see light. So any possibility we have of having perception or depth of understanding, it's only through him. And even the saints and the spiritual writers down the centuries have all said that when we come to understand spiritual things more and more, it is the process of enlightenment. That is the light entering into us, giving us wisdom, understanding, counsel, fortitude, knowledge, piety, and the fear of the Lord. Sorry, I'm not up to date with the funny names they use nowadays. So Jesus said, I was able to be a new sun for souls. That is a source of life and light. And just as the sun, which I created in the heavens, covers the whole earth with its light without denying the effects to anyone, though it doesn't depart from the heavens, but it unleashes from its centers the rays which bring to the earth the goods that the sun contains. That's the life and the light and the ability to grow and to enable the plants to photosynthesize and all of that. So in the same way, he said, without departing from me, with its inaccessible light, that's 1 Timothy, oh, sorry, it's not 1 Timothy, it's 2, I wrote down 1 for some reason. It's 2 Timothy 6:16. God dwells in unapproachable light. Okay. So Jesus says, in the same way, without departing from me, with its inaccessible light, my divinity formed in me spokes of light. Now, spokes and rays are talking about the same thing. But if you think of spokes, think of a bicycle. And you've got this center, and all the spokes are coming out of this center, and then you have the rim, which represents the world. So all the spokes are governed and held in this center. So he said, spokes of light came out from me, and these rays covered everyone and everything. Now notice the love without borders. And Jesus said, and I, at each instant, now watch this, covered each thought. At each instant, I covered each word. At each instant, I covered each act of all creatures. Now, he does it at each instant. That's why I say to the Lord, I want to fuse all of me in all of you all the time, every nanosecond. If you want to support me every instant, I want to be in there to be supported every instant. This is a two-way process. So, he said, I at each instant covered each thought, I covered each word, I covered each act of all creatures, and I constituted myself the perennial glory to the Father for each thought, word, and so on of all human generations. Perennial means continuous. And by continuous, he means from Adam to me, and from me to the end, from Adam to Zachary, every single one of us. He covered us all. We have absolutely no excuse for not reaching the fullness. We have no excuse at all. He's done everything for us. We just have to enter into it, surrender to it, let him take over. While rising to the eternal Father, he said, this light descended to take, as though in its power, all human acts in order to illuminate them. There's your John 8:12 and 9:5 again, to warm them, to take away the dreadful coldness of our unbelief and stubbornness and everything, and to repair them. So, over each human act hovers a light that wants to do good to that act. Now, here I am, the action I'm doing at this moment is trying to reflect on this wonderful material that the Lord revealed to Louisa, and hovering over me is this light that actually wants to come in and enlighten the darkness of my intellect and uncover the memory, stir the will, stir the heart, so that what actually comes out of this exercise is something divine and not just human. I just gave you that so that we get practical about it. In me, Jesus said, because he was man and God, doing this was as though natural. He said, my daughter, you don't have this power. You can't make a single act out of all acts. That's what only God can do that. Therefore, in my will, he said, you have to go through each ray covering human thoughts. Oh, dear. One by one, little by little, and you'll follow the same path as my humanity. He could do them all in one fell swoop. We have to do it bit by bit. That's like saying, I'm not giving you the blouse, I'm giving you the threads that make the blouse, and you have to put these threads together. So he's telling us we have work to do in our acts in the divine will. So she immediately goes into obedience and trying to do what he has asked of her. So she said, I tried to go through the first ray, that is, of human thoughts, and then through the second and so on. But, O power of the divine will, while going through those rays, I was so little that I seemed to have become an atom. Now notice, you can only succeed in your nothingness. If Frances thinks she's important enough to do this, because she's Frances, well then, go and do something else. You're wasting your time. She discovers that in her nothingness, she's lifted up and enabled to do it. But if there's something blocking that nothingness, it's not going to happen. She said, because I am an atom, now don't forget that something very, very small can really get places. The light can come in because it's made up of extremely tiny particles. And he tells us that we have to get into this nothingness so that in our nothingness, we can enter into the divine will and we can enter, therefore, into the intelligences of creatures and affect them for good. But if there's anything of the self there, no, it's not going to work. And so it's desperately important that if I say to the Lord, I fuse all of me in all of you all the time, I have to say the next sentence is, and I plunge myself into my abject nothingness so that this nothingness can flow in your allness. Those two go together because it's only in our nothingness that the thing actually works. So she said, I was so little that I seemed to have become an atom. But the atom was now in the divine intelligence. See, that's the difference. Because she's so small, so tiny, the infinite intelligence of God allows her to come in. Because no pride is allowed in, you see. Nothing unholy or unworthy can enter the presence of God. So pride and arrogance and self-importance and all of that, that doesn't get in. So now that she's in the divine intelligence, because she's fused, that's the difference. And that's what makes it possible for us to do what the Lord actually asks. And she said, because of that, going through the intelligences of all creatures. At one stage, she said, I went through the word. And then in the divine motion, going through the words of creatures. So she goes through the thought and then the thoughts of creatures, the word and the words of creatures, the act and the acts of creatures and so on and so forth. And the divinity in seeing my extreme littleness within their intelligence, within their word and within their emotion, taken by love for my littleness, notice the emphasis on the littleness all the time, they remained enraptured and they were pleased. I want to give you 1 Peter 5:5-9. The devil can only attack if there's something there to attack. But if there's nothingness, there's nothing for the devil to attack. So now you know the solution. And the Holy Trinity said, this littleness enraptures us. And in seeing her enter into our very acts, to do them together with us, and to diffuse them over all souls, we feel such joy and such satisfaction because love is being allowed to operate in a human being. They are infinite, absolute, divine love, but love is now operating in a human being who wants to do something to help other human beings. Love serves, you see, and love lives by giving, 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 giving all the time. So they were absolutely delighted. So this littleness enraptures us, and in seeing her enter our very acts to do them together with us and to diffuse them over all, we feel such joy and such satisfaction as we receive our own glory. And with all love, we give her the freedom to enter into us and let her operate within us, because operating within the Blessed Trinity is operating in love and in service to God and man. Louisa said she felt all confused on hearing this, and she said to herself, I'm not doing anything. It's the divine will who carries me in his arms. And therefore, all the glory is of the adorable will. But you see, we have to remember what we were told at the very beginning, which is, if you desire it, I will do it, Jesus says. So our acts and prayers seem to be nothing to us. We're saying nice things, okay? So Jesus has to explain what actually happens when we fuse ourselves and enter the sphere of eternity. And that's where we're going in January 27, 1925. So there's wonderful teaching here on entering the sphere of eternity. So what is fusing? What happens? And who does what? Okay. So while I was fusing myself in the holy divine volition, Louisa said, I thought to myself, before when I used to fuse myself in the holy supreme volition, Jesus was with me. Hold me a second. Just hold on a second. So I want to start again at January the 27th, 1925. So we're going to look at what fusing actually is. So Louisa said, while I was fusing myself in the holy divine volition, I thought to myself, before, when I used to fuse myself in the holy supreme volition, Jesus was with me. And I would enter into the sphere of eternity, that's the it, together with him. And so entering it was a reality. Now she means a felt experience. I actually felt this happening, she says. But now I don't see him. So I don't know whether I enter into the eternal volition or not. I feel rather as if it was a little lesson learnt by heart or a way of speaking. Now, what Jesus has done there is he's got Louisa to express our problem. She usually enters the divine volition experientially, because he's teaching her to teach everybody else. But we're learning from her what to do, and we're simply obeying what we were told, and we're hoping it works for us, because we're not having her experiential actions. And so we have to remember the first letter of Peter, chapter 1, verses 8 to 9. You don't see him, but you love him, and you're filled with a joy so glorious that people are utterly amazed. And so Jesus has to explain to her our position, that we're acting totally by faith, which is Galatians 3:11. She was having huge experiences in order to get this revelation to pass on to us, but we're acting totally in faith. And so how does it affect us? Now, she says, while I was thinking about this, my beloved Jesus moved in my interior, and taking one of my hands in his, he pushed me up high. Now watch, she's doing the words, this is what he's doing. He pushed me up high and told me, my daughter, you must know that whether you see me or not, every time you fuse yourself in my will, from within your interior, I take your hand and I push you up high. In other words, he alone can make it a divine act. From within your interior, I take your hand and I push you up high. And from heaven, I take you with my other hand to take your other hand and pull you up into our midst, into our endless will. In other words, you desire it, I do it. He is the one who has to make this a divine act for us, because he is the one who is divine. So you are in between my hands and in my arms. So do your little acts. This is what I'm doing. We're giving him an opportunity to do this wonderful work. So in the next paragraph, then, he talks about taking us into his first act. So you must know, he said, that all the acts done in our will enter into the first act when we created the whole universe. When he said the first fiat that brought the whole universe into being, he says everything you do is in that act. And the acts of the human being in becoming one with the divine, because there's only one will in these acts done in the divine will, they will diffuse over all created things, just as our will is diffused everywhere. And they constitute themselves the return of love, adoration, and continuous glory for everything. That means everything that God issued in the universe. Only that which is done in our will begins almost together with us. I love the little word almost, because he's telling us that our acts have got to go back into the divine will and therefore diffuse over the whole of the universe. Okay? And he says it goes almost back. Why does he say almost? Because we weren't there at the fiat. We come later. And it's absolutely fantastic that our acts can be brought right back into this first act. So, only that which is done in our will, Jesus said, begins almost together with us to give us the return of perennial love, adoration, but in a divine manner and a glory that never ends. We have this extraordinary privilege of giving divine glory, divine reparation. It's really unbelievable. And divine love and all the rest of it. And since the love we have for all the things created by us, Jesus said, is so great that we did not permit that they go out of our will. Now, the first thing he's saying here now, first of all, he tells us what's happening in the act. And then he says that our acts have got to be brought into that first act at the beginning of the creation of the universe. And then he's going to separate two lots. One is that all of creation is as beautiful as it was in the beginning because they have no free will. And then he comes in the next paragraph to talk about us, that we're different to the rest of the whole of creation because he wanted something from us that he didn't ask of anything else in creation, that we would choose to come back, that we would choose to love him, that we would choose to surrender to him. So think of all that is in the universe that doesn't have free will, and this is what we're talking about now. Since the love we have for all the things created by us is so great that we did not permit that they go out of our will as we created them, so they all remained with us, and our will made itself the preserver and the nourisher of the whole of creation. And this is why all things remain fresh and new and beautiful, nor do they grow or decrease as they were all created perfect by us. And therefore, they're not subject to any kind of alteration. They all preserve their origin because they allowed themselves to be nourished and preserved by our will. And so they remain around us for our glory. Now we come to human beings. And this is different. So he said, now, the working of the human being in our will enters into our own works. That's different. And our will makes itself the nourisher, the preserver, and the act of the very act of the creature. In other words, we had it explained in the first paragraph that we do what we can to enter into the divine will. Jesus does everything else. In other words, he's the one who actually lifts it up to the sphere of eternity and makes it a divine act. Okay. So here he says that the divine will makes itself the nourisher and the preserver of the very act that we do. These acts done in our will by the creature place themselves around us and are transfused in all human things, and they sing our perennial glory. But how different is our operating from that of the creature, as well as the love with which we operate? So I want to give you Isaiah 55, verses 8 to 9 there, where the Lord says, our ways, my ways, are very different to your ways. My way of thinking is very different to yours. In fact, the way we think is as different to yours as the heavens are from the earth. And I want to give you Psalm 145, verse 17, that God only ever acts out of love, and you cannot say that about human beings. So he said, the love with which we operated also is very different. So when we come to do rounds or prayers in the divine will, it's important to pick that up. Lord, in your holy will, I want to love with the love with which you created us. So he says, we operate, and our love for the work we do is so great that we don't permit that it go out of ourselves. It's no free will, so that it may lose nothing of the beauty with which it was made. But on the other hand, if the human creature operates, she's not able to do the work by herself. Rather, many times she doesn't even know what has become of her work. She doesn't even know if it became dirty or if they made a rag of it, which is a sign of her little love for her own works, which is very interesting. And because the creature has gone out of her origin, that is the divine will from which she came, she has lost true love. Now notice the true love. She's lost true love for God. Now the true love for God is Deuteronomy 6, 4 to 10. You shall love the Lord your God with all your heart, with all your soul, with all your mind, with all your being, and with all your strength, and you shall love your neighbor as yourself. There isn't a lot of that going around. So the human being has lost true love towards God. She's lost true love towards herself and towards her works. I wanted man to be in my will of his own will. Now, we're the only ones given free will. So he wants us to make the choice of glorifying and praising and serving God. The rest of creation was not given the choice, but we were. So I wanted man to be in our will of his own will, not by force, because I loved him more than all the other created things, and I wanted him to be king. That's Genesis 1:28, that he made man lord of the earth in the midst of my works. But man, ever ungrateful, wanted to go out of his origin. Therefore, he was transformed and lost his freshness and beauty and became subject to continuous alterations and changes. So what happened in the Garden of Eden is that man was led by his seducer to choose to be God himself. And what a terrible God he makes. He only becomes a tyrant. So, and Jesus said, as much as I call him to return to his origin, he plays deaf, pretending not to hear me. And my love is so great that I keep waiting for him and I continue to call him. That's the father of the prodigal son in Luke 15, continuously calling. Now, it's also, that sentence is also a summary of the whole of the Old Testament, that God was continuously calling his people to come back. So let's move on to February the 8th, 1925. In our charismatic renewal days, we used to sing a lovely little thing called "Reign in Me, Sovereign Lord, Reign in Me." And this is what it is talking about in February the 8th, 1925, that the Lord wants to reign in us and through us. He wants to come as master of the house, not as a guest. So Louisa says, "This morning my sweet Jesus made himself seen in so much suffering that my poor soul felt consumed with compassion. He had all his limbs dislocated, deep wounds so embittered, and Jesus moaned and writhed for the bitterness of the spasm. He placed himself near me, as though wanting to share his pain with me. By merely looking at him, I felt pain, his pain being reflected in me." That's 2 Corinthians 3:18. "You become like that which you worship. And Jesus' all goodness told me, 'My daughter, I can take no more. Touch my embittered wounds so as to soothe them. Impress your kiss of love upon them so that your love may mitigate the spasm I feel. This state of mine, so painful, watch this now, is the true portrait of the way in which my will finds itself in the midst of creatures.'" Now, we have to realize that the visions that Jesus gives to Louisa of himself in suffering, it's not Jesus' condition now. He's in glory. Suffering can no longer touch him. And so it's usually either the condition of the church that she has to intercede for. And in this case, Jesus shows on his own body the condition of the divine will in the world, that we have crucified the divine will in humanity. And people just don't expect that this image would be given. He said, "This is a true portrait of the way in which my will finds itself in the midst of creatures. It is present in their midst because nothing can survive without it. But although divided, because as they do their own will and not mine, the divine will remains dislocated and wounded by creatures. Therefore, unite your will to mine and give me a relief for my dislocation." So he's saying that the divine will is experiencing a spiritual crucifixion in the world today. And he's asking of us a spiritual crucifixion to mend it. And that is that we surrender finally our wills to him, and that he actually comes to reign in you and me and you and me and you and me, and it spreads out more and more and more. And the more the divine will takes up a residence on earth, the more we have the return of Jesus in glory. So Louisa said, "I clasped him to myself, I kissed the wounds of his hands." Now, so we usually find her doing this, that if she's asked to do something, she'll do it immediately. "Oh, how embittered they were because of the many works, even holy ones, which do not have their origin in the will of God." Now, when I was thinking about this, I said to the Lord, "Put into my head some idea of a holy work that's not actually pleasing to you." And I was very surprised at what came into my head. I'll offer it to you. I'm not infallible. It doesn't mean you have to take it as gospel. But what came into my head after I asked him was the way Catholics turn pilgrimages into holidays. You turn something holy into something that may or may not be holy. But a pilgrimage should never be a holiday. A pilgrimage should be a very serious seeking of God. So she said, "How embittered the wounds were because of the many works, even holy ones, which do not have their origin in the will of God. In order to soothe their pain, I squeezed them in my hands and Jesus let me do everything. Even more, he wanted it. And so I remained he remained with me for almost the whole morning. Finally, before leaving me, he said, "My daughter, you've soothed me. I feel my bones in place. But do you know who can soothe me and rejoin my dislocated bones? It is the one who lets my will reign within herself." Now notice the word reign. Our God reigns. Okay. And he's not saying the one who says little divine will prayers nicely, and for that moment you're in the divine will. He's not saying that. He's saying the one who will allow him to reign permanently in him. They're the ones who can truly make reparation. When the soul puts her will aside, giving it not even one act of life, my will acts as the master of the soul. It reigns, it commands, it rules. It is as if it were in its own house. That is, it's like being in the celestial fatherland. So, since it is my house and I act as the master, I dispose, I place from my own, because as my dwelling, I can place in it whatever I want. I can make of it whatever I want because it's my house. We have an expression in Ireland that says, it's my own house, I can sit and stand where I like. In other words, if we genuinely hand over to him, he takes it. He takes possession of us as we take possession of him. And the possession of God is heaven on earth. I can place in it whatever I want. I can make of it whatever I want, and I receive the greatest honor and glory that the creature can give me. This is the ultimate sacrifice that we can make. And he has told us several times that if we make this sacrifice, there is nothing else that he asks. On the other hand, if one wants to do her own will, this is the big but, because he always gives you the other side as well. She's the one who acts as the master. She disposes and commands. And my will remains like a poor stranger, neglected, and maybe sometimes even despised. I would want to place from my things from my own, but I can't, he says, because the human will doesn't want to surrender the place to me. Even in holy things, it wants to act as the head, and I can place nothing of my own. How uncomfortable I feel in the soul who makes her own will reign. How uncomfortable. It's a very poignant statement. And I want to give you Revelation 3:20 there, because with that soul, he has to stand at the door and knock, asking to be allowed in. Okay. So what he's going to do in the next long paragraph is give us an example of what he's talking about. He said, look, it's like a father who goes to visit a son of his who is far away. Now, of course, the father is God and the son who's far away is us on the earth. Or a friend who goes to visit another friend. As he knocks, the door is opened, but he's left there standing at the door in the first room. No one prepares lunch for him or a bed on which he can sleep. They let him share neither in their joys nor in their sorrows. What an affront. What sorrow for this father or friend. If he has brought treasures to compliment the other ones, he doesn't leave anything. He goes away, pierced to the depth of his soul. On the other hand, when someone else, as soon as they see him, they put themselves in feast, they prepare the most beautiful lunch, the softest of beds. Even more, they give him full lordship of the whole house and also over themselves. Is not this the greatest honor, love, respect, and subjection that can be offered to a father or a friend? And what beautiful good things will these not leave to them to requite them for so much generosity? He said, that's the way it is with me and my will. It's a very simple reflection, but one that touches us because it touches on things that happen in our daily lives. Such is my will. It comes from heaven in order to dwell in souls. But instead of letting me be the master, they keep me like a stranger or a destitute. but my will does not depart. Even though they keep me like a stranger, I remain in their midst waiting in order to give them my goods, my graces, and my sanctity. This is an awful statement that we leave God waiting, 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 waiting for years, years, maybe the whole of our lives. It's very frightening. So I want to give you, to illustrate what Jesus is talking here, Luke 11, verses 5 to 13. That's the man coming at night, knocking at the door, asking for bread. And Luke 18, verses 1 to 8, that is the poor woman going to the judge looking for justice, and she's sent away all the time. So let's come to February the 15th, 1925. The divine will in heaven is confirming, beatifying the bearer of happiness and the divinizer. Oh, wow. So this is a very important one about abandonment. Louisa said, I was abandoning all of myself in the most holy will of God. And in this, look at the words total, look at the word full, abandonment. I felt a new heaven within me. Now notice the total and the full. This is 100%. This is not just sort of feeling nice for 5 minutes. In this total and full abandonment, I felt a new heaven within me, an air all divine, which infused new life into me. And my beloved Jesus, moving in my interior, seemed to be stretching out his arms towards me to receive me and hide me within himself. Placing me under this new heaven of his will, which by his grace had formed in me, with great contentment, I breathed the balsamic and sweet air of his most holy will. And absolutely amazed, I said, my love, my Jesus, how beautiful is the heaven of your will. How enjoyable it is to be under it. Oh, how refreshing and salutary is this celestial air. Now, she's allowed to experience it because otherwise she will only give us doctrinal stuff. Whereas if she has experienced it and then tells us the testimony, it actually comes across easier to us. So pressing her more to himself, Jesus said, daughter of my will, each act in my will is a new heaven. Now, the thing is, we don't feel it like Louisa has felt it. And she has been allowed to feel it to enable us to enter into the reality of what's happening. Each act of my will is a new heaven. And this new heaven extends above the head of the soul. Now, I can't explain that anatomically or otherwise. I didn't know the head, the soul had a head. So whether it means all around you like a halo, I'm not completely sure. It extends above the head of the soul, one more beautiful than the other. Now, don't forget each act. So that means if one act puts a kind of a halo of light around me, or an aura, as people would say nowadays, then the more you do, the deeper that's going to get, and the more compact it's going to get, the more sure it's going to get. You're literally building a kingdom. The air of these heavens is divine, and it brings with itself sanctity, love, light, fortitude, and all tastes together. Now, all tastes is everything that can come to us from the divinity. This is why one feels a balsamic and sweet air. My will in heaven, what does it do? It confirms and it beatifies. It is the bearer of happiness, and it is the all-pervasive transformer and divinizer of everything within itself. Now, you have to go back and take this apart piece by piece, because what's going on in heaven in the divine will be going on in our souls piece by piece as we add more acts and more and more and more acts. It's in reading this that I remember with a smile a statement that Tom Fahey made to me when he visited me here in my home a couple of years ago. And you know, Tom is in heaven now. And at one stage he said to me, "What age are you?" So I told him my age. He said, "Oh, you and I are in a hurry to do all our acts," he said, "to really build this, really, really build it." And he got really excited. It was lovely to see it. And I can understand it from what is written here. "My will in heaven," he said, "is the confirming and beatifying bearer of happiness. It is the all-pervasive transformer and divinizer of everything." God is divine. Everything he touches, he divinizes. Now, the church has taught us from the beginning that Jesus became man in order to divinize us. Excuse my bad English now. He was humanized in order to divinize us. This was God's intention all the time, because God is immutable. On the other hand, he said, in the soul who possesses these new heavens, they're the acts that you're doing. In the soul who possesses these new heavens of my will on earth, that is during our lifetime, my will is working. Now it says operating. I'm just using a word that we use. My will works away. And as it operates, it delights in extending new heavens. In other words, God is a creator. And if you give him a chance, he creates. And we give him a chance when we are doing more and more fusing and acts in the divine will. That gives him a chance to create in us. Therefore, my will works and operates more in the pilgrim soul than in the celestial Jerusalem. So he's working more in souls on earth than in heaven. And it's obvious why, because the folks in heaven finished their journey and we haven't. Up there in heaven, the works of the saints are finished. There's nothing else to do. But down here on earth, the divine will has always something to do in the soul in whom it reigns. So as long as we're alive, the divine will wants to work more and more and more. This is why the divine will wants everything for itself, nor does it want to leave even one act in our human will. Because if everything is handed over to him, he makes everything divine. Now, if you think of one of these famous, magnificent paintings that we see in museums, and you look at any part of it and you just see the perfection of each part of this wonderful picture. Well, if there was one part of it that was out of sync with the rest of it, it would be awful. And it would lose most of its value. Now, some of these paintings sell for 10 million. But if there was a blotch in the thing, or there was a mistake in the way that the author actually did his painting, it would lose that value. And Jesus is saying that when we put human acts in, interfering with the divine acts that he wants to do in us, then we are also putting a terrible blotch on the work that he's doing in us. So he said, the divine will doesn't want to leave even one act to our human will, because the divine will wants to do much. And for every act, the divine will, were to surrender to the human will, it would fail to extend one more heaven. There's the spoiling of the painting. And it would be one work less for the divine will. You don't understand what happens in the soul when she gives my will all the freedom to work within her and the soul operates in my will. He said, you've no idea, if only you could grasp it. So I think after tonight, one of the prayers we need to pray to the Lord is, help me to understand. Open my understanding. Don't leave me in darkness. Okay, it's a very important prayer. Actually, there's a prayer in one of the Psalms. I'm not sure if it's Psalm 13. Open my eyes, O Lord, lest I sleep in death, lest the enemy say I have overcome her. And it would be a terrifying victory on the part of the enemy to deceive us into thinking that not giving the whole of ourselves is okay. It would be a terrifying victory. We would have gone 2/3 of the way up Mount Everest and not gone the rest of it. It'd be frightening. He said, you don't understand what happens. And then he tries to give us an example to illuminate this. And he talks about the power of a storm on the sea. Look, he said, imagine the sea when the waves rise up so powerful and high that the power of the waves transports not only the waters, but all the fish up high as well, in such a way that in those waves one can see, carried by the power of the storm, how the fish also have come from the bottom of the sea, from their everyday dwelling, to rise up high together with the waves. Now, usually if there's a storm, the fish go down to hide in the calm waters down below. But if you have a tsunami, or you've got an earthquake under the sea, and the waters are pushed up from the bottom, then the fish and everything are thrown up. So he says they're pushed up from the bottom of the sea, from their everyday dwelling, to rise up higher together with the waves. The waves have overwhelmed them, and they've not been able to resist their power. While without the power of the waves, they were unable to go out of their harbour. Oh, he said, if the sea had a power without limit, it would make all the water overflow from the bed of the sea, forming gigantic waves, they're the tsunamis, with all the fish overwhelmed within them. But what the sea cannot do, because it's limited in its power, and that limit of the power of the sea is given in the book of Job, chapter 38, verses 8 to 11. When you read the words that your mother probably told you as well, and mine did too, thus far and no further. Only that the mother probably meant it to you and me instead of the sea. God said to the sea, thus far and no further. And so he put a limit. Otherwise, the sea could overflow completely onto the land, which happened, of course, in the Great Flood. So Jesus says, as the divine will makes the acts of the soul its own. Now look at that. Here we are, fusing ourselves in the divine will. And so we need the divine will to make our acts its own. And by operating in us, the divine will forms its eternal waves in the soul. And within these waves, the divine will overwhelms everything. In these waves, one can see what my humanity did. You can see the works of my celestial mother. You can also see the works of all the saints and everything else that the divinity did. Once you get into the divine will, everything is placed in motion. And of course, motion means life. Now, my will is more than the sea. Our works and those of the saints can be symbolized by the fish that live in the sea. When my will operates in the soul, and also outside of the soul, everything which is present in the divine will moves and rises. All works place themselves in order to repeat for us glory, love, and adoration. Now, the divine will is more than the sea, so everything is in that, all the works, everything are in that, no matter whose works you're talking about.
Can you hear me now?
If the divine will moves, then everything moves with the divine will. And the Lord puts absolutely everything into order. As the divine will moves and rises, all works place themselves in order to repeat for us glory, love, and adoration. They pass before us as though in a parade, saying to us, we are your works. You are great and wonderful. Now, for the praise of God's creation, go to Psalm 136 and Psalm 148, because the last five Psalms in the Psalter is really all creation giving a standing ovation to God. The Psalter is the most wonderful book. It has the complete journey of the human race from its fall and sinfulness to its rising. And finally, the whole of creation praises and glorifies God forever. It's just beautiful. What he's saying here is that all of creation says to God, you are great and wonderful. You are so beautiful. And then Jesus says, my love encloses everything that is beautiful and good. And when it operates, it leaves nothing behind, so that nothing of what is ours may be missing in that act, so that our glory may be complete. Now notice, he does all the work. And he makes sure that when we fuse in the divine will, and when we do our acts in the divine will, that that act is a complete act. It has everything that he, the divine will, wants, but only he can actually complete it, so that our glory may be complete. And there's nothing to be surprised about, he said, because it is the eternal operating that's carried on in the soul. Now, if you have your book with you, please color that. It's the eternal operating in the soul. Therefore, the operating of my will can be called an eternal wave, which overwhelms heaven and earth as though in one single point. Now, I love this one single point. A singularity is what the astrophysicists call it. This one single point contains everything. It has no past and it has no future. That's why we can pray for all souls, past, present, and future, because they're only past and future to us. They're not past and future to him. Everything is present. Okay? So he said, operating of my will can be called an eternal wave, which overwhelms heaven and earth as though in a single point, and then diffuses over all and is the bearer of a divine act. Oh, how heaven delights when it sees the eternal will operate in the soul. Heaven operating on earth. That's the beginning of the New Jerusalem. In fact, since their works are confirmed in the divine will in heaven, they see their works flow within that divine act, and they feel their glory, happiness, and joys being redoubled, okay? Because everything is in that singularity. Everything is in that one point. Therefore, since you are the little daughter of my supreme volition, I recommend to you, leave each act of yours, pray to the eternal waves of my will. Please, please underline that one. Leave each one of your acts, pray to the eternal waves of my will, so that as these waves reach the foot of our throne in heaven, we may confirm you more and more as our true daughter of our will, and that we may grant you charters of grace for your brothers and our children. Now, the charters of grace are that she has this office given to her, that it is through her that the kingdom of the divine will is to be opened to the earth, and she will win those charters of grace from the Lord. I think that's absolutely fantastic. So I want to finish there for tonight. And I want to finish with a little prayer. Jesus, precious Savior, I fuse all of me in all of you all the time. I want to take your power, your wisdom, and your love to myself. I want to make them my own with your will, so that I can pray to you with all your own things. I come before your supreme